whatever Ruby said because the previous day, a Ruby associate had ordered her to meet him and threatened, "If you're not down there, you won't be around long." Karen Carlin arrived at the Nichols garage before Ruby did. Then Ruby called the parking attendant and told him to lend Carlin $5 and be sure to timestamp the receipt, for which Ruby would reimburse him. When Ruby arrived at the garage, his cover story was that he was supposed to loan Carlin another $25. Ruby claimed he didn't have the cash to lend and couldn't get it, ignoring the fact that his club and its safe were next door. The plan was for Ruby to wire Carlin the money the next day from a Western Union office only one block from the police station where Oswald would be moved. The following day, Ruby's time-stamped Western Union receipt would be designed to prove that Ruby just happened to be near the police station when Oswald was being moved. It's clear this was only a cover story since there were two Western Union offices much closer to Ruby's Oak Cliff apartment. There was no need for Ruby to go all the way downtown to use the Western Union office near the police station, except for the fact that Ruby had to silence Oswald. On November 24, 1963, at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, CIA Director McCone met with President Johnson to tell him about the Cuban situation, including our operational plans against Cuba, according to McCone's notes. LBJ and McCone no doubt also discussed the latest information from Mexico City that seemed to implicate Fidel Castro in JFK's murder. Unaware that information would later be discredited, in another meeting that weekend, LBJ asked former JFK aide Ted Sorensen, "What do you think of the possibility of a foreign government being involved in JFK's assassination?" In South Carolina, on November 24, white supremacist and Bannister associate Joseph Miltier was having breakfast with his friend William Somerset, unaware that Somerset was an informant for the Miami police. Earlier, Miltier had told Somerset that Oswald hasn't said anything and he will not say anything. Miltier also made it clear that despite the initial reports of Oswald's stay in Russia and his seeming public support of Fidel Castro, Oswald was not connected with Moscow or any big communist leaders. When the subject of JFK's murder came up again, Miltier advised that they did not have to worry about Lee Harvey Oswald getting caught because he doesn't know anything. However, as if he needed to make sure, Miltier excused himself so that he could telephone someone. On the morning of November 24 in Dallas, Jack Ruby was spruced up, dressed in his finest, ready for the spotlight he was sure to occupy after he completed his assignment for Carlos Marcello. Ruby was undoubtedly nervous, but not about the length of time he might have to spend in jail after shooting Oswald. Under Texas law, for murders involving a sudden passion, the sentence could be as brief as 2 years, with time off for good behavior, or sometimes even just probation, with no prison time. Instead, Ruby was probably worried only that after he pulled out his gun and started shooting at Oswald, he might hit a policeman or a policeman might start shooting at him. Getting into the police station basement where the transfer would take place would be no problem for Ruby, since the FBI later acknowledged that, as a result of his friendship with a number of police officers, Ruby had easy accessibility to the Dallas Police Department. The executive director of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, former mafia prosecutor G. Robert Blakey, said that the murder of Oswald by Jack Ruby had all the earmarks of an organized crime hit. The committee also found that Ruby's shooting Oswald wasn't spontaneous, and that Ruby probably had help entering the basement of the police station for the transfer. The staffs of both the committee and the Warren Commission focused particular attention on one of Ruby's police associates. Blakey was convinced that Sergeant Patrick Dean had been the one who let Jack Ruby in the basement on the morning of the 24th. Sergeant Dean refused to testify to Blakey's committee, and even told author Peter Dale Scott of his longtime relationship with Joe Civello, the mobster who ran Dallas for Carlos Marcello. Scott also notes that Dean was in charge of security in the Dallas basement when Oswald was murdered, and that Dean later failed a lie detector test about Ruby's access to the basement. Dean also worked in narcotics, which Ruby was also involved in with Civello and Marcello. As had apparently been planned the night before, at 10:19 a.m. Central Standard Time, dancer Karen Carlin in Fort Worth called Ruby's home, supposedly to ask him to send her money. It's doubtful that Ruby was there, since an earlier call to Ruby's home by his regular housekeeper was answered by someone who didn't seem to recognize her voice. At 10:45 a.m., Ruby was talking to a TV news crew in front of the police station before heading to the Western Union office. At 11 a.m., Sergeant Dean apparently removed police who had been guarding an interior door to the basement. Upstairs, in Detective Fritz's office, a small group of officials were questioning Oswald, but at 11:15 a.m., they were told their time was up. However, the transfer car wasn't in position, so the group with Oswald had to slow its passage toward the basement. The basement was packed with at least 70 policemen and 40 newsmen. At Western Union, Ruby wired Carlin the money at 11:17 a.m. and then headed back to the police station, only a block away. The timing was tight for Ruby to have any hope of claiming a sudden passion defense, but he had plenty of associates who could signal when he should arrive. For example, only 1 minute after Ruby left the Western Union office, his attorney entered the police station and saw Oswald coming out of the jail elevator. Ruby's attorney turned to leave, telling a police detective, "That's all I wanted to see." Even with the crowds of press and police, no one ever claimed to have seen Ruby actually enter the police basement, one more indication that he must have had help in doing so. Ruby most likely entered the basement from the alley that runs between the Western Union office and the police station. One officer claimed to have seen an unidentified white male walk down the ramp into the basement, past Officer Roy Vaughn, who was guarding the ramp. But that officer failed a polygraph test, while Officer Vaughn, who consistently said he had not let Ruby down the ramp, passed his polygraph test. 7 witnesses agreed with Vaughn. Around 11:20 a.m., Oswald walked through the door, flanked by 2 Dallas police detectives. As soon as he was visible, a car horn blew and is audible on the news broadcast of the transfer. At 11:21, Ruby surged out of the crowd and fired one shot into Oswald's abdomen. The basement erupted in pandemonium. As Oswald was rushed to Parkland Hospital, the apprehended Ruby appeared to police officer Don Ray Archer as being extremely agitated and nervous, continually inquiring whether Oswald was dead or alive. Oswald died at 1:07 p.m. It was only after Ruby was told that his victim was dead that Ruby calmed down, according to Marcello's biographer, John H. Davis. Davis notes that even after an officer told Ruby, "It looks like it's going to be the electric chair for you," Ruby immediately relaxed and even managed a wan smile. Officer Archer said it seemed at that time that Ruby felt his own life depended on the success of his mission, that if Oswald had not died, he, Jack Ruby, would have been killed. Later that day, a Secret Service agent interviewed a highly agitated Karen Carlin. She blurted out to the agent that Oswald, Jack Ruby, and other individuals unknown to her were involved in a plot to assassinate Kennedy, and that she would be killed if she gave any information to authorities. As Officer Archer had suspected, Ruby had apparently been threatened with death as well, and not just for himself. Ruby would soon be visited in jail by Marcello underboss Joe Campisi, Sr. Ruby had last seen Campisi at his restaurant on the night before JFK's murder. Campisi was also close to Sheriff Bill Decker, in whose custody Ruby would spend most of the rest of his life, reportedly in a cell overlooking Dealey Plaza. When Ruby was later asked in a polygraph examination if members of your own family are now in danger because of what you did, Ruby said, "Yes." Ruby's sister later testified that Ruby worried about their brother Earl being dismembered and Earl's children being dismembered and their arms and legs cut off. At the time, a Chicago mobster associate of Richard Kane was well known in the underworld for that type of mafia retribution. Years later, Johnny Rosselli's legs were cut off after Santo Traficante had him murdered. In South Carolina, Joseph Miltier had completed his phone call and rejoined his friend William Somerset. After the radio broadcast the news about Oswald's death, Miltier told his friend, "That makes it work perfect. Now we have no worry." Now that Lee Oswald was dead, Carlos Marcello would soon be free from worry. After Oswald's murder, David Ferry returned to New Orleans and turned himself in to authorities. The FBI and Secret Service were investigating Jack Martin's allegations, and the news media had started to get wind not just of Ferry, but even Marcello, as possibly being involved in JFK's death. However, Martin was an unstable individual and quickly backed away from his charges, and within 48 hours, the entire incident had blown over. That was in spite of the fact that Ferry admitted to the FBI he had severely criticized JFK and possibly said he ought to be shot, and that he had been critical of any president riding in an open car, and said that anyone could hide in the bushes and shoot a president. Ferry was also able to produce his library card when the agents asked, so he was released, and the investigation dropped. Former FBI supervisor Guy Bannister was briefly interviewed by authorities, but not investigated. Statements by the local FBI to the press seemed to place responsibility for the whole incident on District Attorney Jim Garrison. The matter had been staunched before it could become national news, and the press and the authorities would soon forget the whole thing, at least for a few years. Carlos Marcello had managed to emerge unscathed from the weekend crisis that could have exposed the roles of David Ferry and Guy Bannister in JFK's murder, and even led to the Godfather himself. Marcello knew that Ruby was a longtime mob associate who could be trusted not to talk. But the Godfather realized there were still avenues investigators could pursue that could lead to his associates. So, even as the government continued to scramble to deal with the aftermath of two assassinations, including the national security implications of JFK's murder and the coup plan that was on hold, Marcello, Traficante, and Rosselli implemented plans to keep attention focused away from themselves and toward Fidel Castro. Chapter 17. Secret Investigations and Getting Away with Murder. In the coming months and years, Carlos Marcello would have other close calls that could have exposed his role in the assassination. Those would continue through the time of his 1985 confession to Jack Van Lanningham and its almost deadly aftermath. Marcello and Santo Traficante used two basic strategies to conceal their roles in JFK's murder, at the time and for years to come. First, along with Johnny Rosselli, the two Godfathers continued to exploit their work on the unauthorized CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel, to gain a measure of protection from close scrutiny. Those few CIA officials who knew about the plots would be loath to look seriously at the possibility that their own operation was somehow involved in JFK's murder. To do so would cost their own careers and perhaps even bring themselves and the agency under suspicion. In addition, parts of the CIA mafia plots involving the mob bosses would continue in December 1963 and beyond. Second, Marcello and Traficante used the legitimate national security concerns surrounding the coup plan with Almeida to keep the pressure on U.S. officials to withhold key information from investigators, the press, and the public to protect the U.S. government's ally high in the Cuban government. That pressure included continuing to have their own men float Castro-killed JFK stories that would find their way to occasionally receptive officials in Washington. Those stories would sometimes travel through government channels and other times through the press. Commander Almeida would remain high in the Cuban government and unexposed for decades, so protecting his life and his family would be a legitimate national security concern for a series of presidents and CIA directors from 1963 until Almeida's death in 2009. One unexpected benefit of the first two approaches for the mob bosses was that various U.S. officials and agencies would use legitimate national concerns to hide a variety of intelligence failures and unauthorized operations, not just the CIA mafia plots, that could have been exposed in a truly wide-ranging investigation of JFK's assassination. National security concerns were also used to hide not just the tight surveillance of Oswald, but the structure that allowed a massive program of domestic surveillance by a raft of agencies, including the CIA, FBI, and military intelligence, to be conducted on thousands of Americans in the 1960s, including some in the JFK investigation. Finally, if their two main strategies failed, the two godfathers would not hesitate to resort to murder to keep their roles in JFK's murder hidden. That wasn't just a threat to help silence a longtime mobster like Jack Ruby. Several murders would be carried out, including their gruesome slaying of Johnny Rosselli. In addition to Ferry and Bannister, in the weeks after JFK's murder, more associates of Carlos Marcello were interviewed by authorities about JFK's murder. Even though at least a dozen of Marcello's associates and family members were interviewed or interrogated, the Godfather would not be mentioned at all in the report of the Warren Commission. One of the consequences of Oswald's death was the creation of the Warren Commission. Sometimes misperceived as something solely created by LBJ so he could control the investigation, the Warren Commission was actually created due to the efforts of several Robert Kennedy associates. Neither President Johnson nor J. Edgar Hoover wanted the Warren Commission, whereas RFK's associates apparently saw a commission as preferable to having the whole investigation in the hands of LBJ and Hoover. Within hours of Oswald's death, Hoover was talking to Nicholas Katzenbach, Robert's trusted deputy attorney general. While a devastated RFK was consumed with funeral preparations and family matters, Katzenbach was essentially running the Justice Department. However, Katzenbach focused on areas like civil rights and wasn't a specialist in the areas of organized crime or HAFA, areas that were now especially relevant in light of Ruby's recent actions. Also, there is no evidence that Katzenbach was ever told about the JFK-Almeida coup plan, which had been withheld from all of RFK's associates who weren't actively involved in the Cuba operation. Hoover's memo of his conversation with Katzenbach on the afternoon of November 24 says, "The thing I am concerned about, and so is Mr. Katzenbach, is having something issued so we can convince the public that Oswald is the real assassin." Katzenbach stated his feelings even more strongly in a memo the following day to LBJ aide Bill Moyers, declaring, "The public must be satisfied that Oswald was the assassin and that he did not have Confederates who are still at large." He even wrote, "Speculation about Oswald's motivation ought to be cut off, and we should have some basis for rebutting thought that this was a communist conspiracy or a right-wing conspiracy to blame it on the communists." In his private memo to Moyers, even Katzenbach notes that, "The facts on Oswald seem almost too pat, too obvious. Marxist, Cuba, Russian wife, etc." Yet Katzenbach's main goal was to head off public speculation or congressional hearings. However, it's important to note that Katzenbach's concerns were shared by other high officials, all of whom were very concerned that rampant speculation about Oswald's ties to Russia or Cuba could trigger a dangerous confrontation with the Soviets at a time when an untested president had just assumed office and much of the nation was still in shock. Even as RFK loyalists pushed for a commission to investigate JFK's murder, Hoover and the FBI continued their investigation, which would later form the basis for much of the commission's work. However, as mentioned in Chapter 2, Author Henry Hurt found that an analysis of FBI documents eventually provided to the Warren Commission showed that at least 60 witnesses claimed that the FBI in some way altered what the witnesses had reported, and more witnesses have reported discrepancies since that time. In addition, in at least two instances, the FBI simply rewrote memos to completely change their meaning, something an FBI agent would only do on orders from the highest authority. We know this only because the National Archives eventually released the original, unaltered memos. In one case, a November 27, 1963 FBI memo about Ruby originally cited his link to Dallas mob boss Joe Civello. But in the version the Warren Commission published, the final three paragraphs of the memo, which cover Civello and his ties to narcotics, are completely missing. In another instance of FBI document tampering, the FBI was trying to make the case that Oswald used brown paper from the book depository to wrap the rifle he allegedly carried to work on the day JFK was shot. The published version of a November 30, 1963 FBI memo says that the book depository paper was found to have the same observable characteristics as the brown paper bag found on the sixth floor after the shooting. However, the National Archives eventually released the original version of the same FBI memo, which said the book depository paper was found not to be identical with the paper gun case found on the sixth floor. The bottom line is that Hoover was using national security concerns to build a case against Oswald, avoid Ruby's mafia ties, and hide anything that might embarrass him or the FBI. Once President Johnson had been persuaded to appoint a presidential commission to investigate JFK's murder, LBJ pulled out all the stops in telling men like Senator Richard Russell why they should join the Warren Commission. LBJ told him, "We've got to take this out of the arena where they're testifying that Khrushchev and Castro did this and did that and kicking us into a war that can kill 40 million Americans in an hour." President Johnson did the same with Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, whom he wanted to chair the commission. The Warren Commission's real purpose was to end speculation about foreign involvement in JFK's murder, which it eventually did. The creation of the Warren Commission was announced on November 29, 1963. According to historian Michael Kurtz, Richard Helms personally persuaded Lyndon Johnson to appoint former CIA Director Alan Dulles to the Warren Commission. The other members were Georgia Senator Richard Russell, Kentucky Senator John Cooper, Louisiana Congressman Hale Boggs, Michigan Congressman Gerald Ford, and disarmament official John J. McCloy. However, before the commission could begin gathering evidence, their final conclusion was preordained when J. Edgar Hoover leaked the FBI's own report and conclusions to the press on December 8, 1963. Hoover used his extensive media connections to make sure the FBI's conclusions, that Oswald acted alone, Ruby acted alone, the two had no connection, and there was no conspiracy in JFK's death, became front-page news. At that point, the commission couldn't really come to any other conclusion, since it would have to depend on Hoover's FBI file for most of their investigative work. In addition, one of the seven men appointed to the commission, Michigan Congressman Gerald Ford, went to one of Hoover's top aides, who wrote that Ford told him he would keep me thoroughly advised as to the activities of the commission. He stated this would have to be on a confidential basis. 5 days later, Ford started delivering on his promise and was soon telling his FBI contact that two members of the commission were still not convinced that the president had been shot from the sixth-floor window of the Texas Book Depository. Alan Dulles knew a great deal about U.S. efforts to assassinate Fidel using Traficante, Roselli, and Marcello, but he didn't tell the rest of the commission. However, Earl Warren's son indicated that the Chief Justice learned something about the plots, and Gerald Ford indicated years later that he'd become aware of them as well, though there is no way to know how much they knew or if it was accurate. Later, Chief Justice Warren and Congressman Ford were the only members of the Warren Commission who went to Dallas to interview Jack Ruby. They even denied the request of the commission's expert on Ruby to accompany them. When Ruby begged Warren and Ford to take him to Washington for questioning away from Dallas, they refused. Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante didn't want more situations like the ferry investigation. So, even as the headlines were full of the FBI investigation and talk of the commission, the Godfather's men quietly supplied a steady stream of stories implying that Castro had ordered JFK's death. This kept national security concerns alive in Washington, and the Castro did it stories of some, like John Martino, even contained hints of the JFK Almeida coup plan. Other mob associates linked to such stories include Rolando Masferrer, Frank Fiorini, and Manuel Artime. The eager audience for these stories included officials such as CIA Director John McCone, J. Edgar Hoover, and Lyndon Johnson. The stories spread by John Martino were especially provocative and accurate about matters the public wouldn't officially learn about for decades. Appearing in small market newspapers and radio broadcasts, Martino's stories blamed Castro for JFK's murder, while hinting at the JFK Almeida coup plan. They were just detailed enough to draw the attention of U.S. officials, but not enough to become major news stories. The stories helped to force top officials into a continuing cover-up about JFK's assassination in order to prevent a public outcry to invade Cuba and to avoid exposing Commander Almeida. Martino's stories began just 2 days after Oswald's murder, when David Ferry was essentially cleared of involvement in JFK's death. The more national security pressure the mafia bosses could keep on officials to stifle the investigation, the better. And the more Oswald looked like a communist working for Fidel Castro, the more Jack Ruby looked like a patriot and not a mobster. Martino was touring the country as a prominent member of the far-right John Birch Society Speakers Bureau, ostensibly to promote his book, I Was Castro's Prisoner. It's unlikely that David Attlee Phillips or others in the CIA were behind Martino's publicity efforts, because Martino's book actually mentioned the name of Phillips' associate, David Morales, a fact that the CIA wanted to keep secret. Martino's phony stories started out mildly, claiming that Oswald had gone to Cuba in the fall of 1963 and had passed out pro-Castro literature in Miami and New Orleans. Those tales brought Martino a visit from the FBI on November 29, but he refused to identify his sources. An article under Martino's name appeared in the December 21, 1963 issue of the right-wing journal Human Events, in which Martino took credit for revealing that the Kennedy administration planned to eliminate Fidel Castro through a putsch, and the plan involved a more or less token invasion from Central America to be synchronized with the coup. A left-wing coalition government was to be set up, and the plan involved the U.S. military occupation of Cuba. At the time, that was more than many high-ranking U.S. officials in the Johnson administration knew about the coup plan. Martino knew about the involvement of Manolo Rey's JURE exile group, and wrote in the article that Oswald made approaches to JURE, another organization of Cuban freedom fighters, but was rejected. As previously noted, 3 months earlier, Martino and Masferrer had been linked to the attempt to smear Rey's group by tying it to Oswald via Dulles JURE member Silvia Odio. When Martino's article was published, only the FBI and a handful of Odio's closest family and friends knew about Oswald's visit to her in Dallas, and nothing about it had appeared in the press. In Martino's first major article, he only hinted that Oswald was working for Fidel Castro when he killed JFK. The following month, Martino revealed new details about the coup plan and implicated Fidel more directly in a January 30, 1964 Memphis Press Scimitar article headlined, "Oswald Was Paid Gunman for Castro, Visitor Says." It quotes John Martino as saying, "Lee Harvey Oswald was paid by Castro to assassinate President Kennedy," and claiming that the murder was in retaliation for JFK's plan to get rid of Castro. Martino described JFK's top-secret coup plan with remarkable precision, saying, "There was to be another invasion and uprising in Cuba, and the Organization of American States was to go into Cuba and help control the country until an election could be set up." Martino even knew that since the death of Kennedy, the work on an invasion has virtually stopped. It's not hard to imagine the consternation Martino's increasingly provocative articles caused among high-ranking officials in Washington. They attracted the attention of J. Edgar Hoover, since FBI agents interviewed Martino yet again on February 15, 1964, in an era when presidents and Congress treated Hoover and his FBI with deference. Martino basically thumbed his nose at the agents, declaring that President Kennedy was engaged in a plot to overthrow the Castro regime by preparing another invasion attempt against Cuba. The frustrated FBI agents wrote that Martino refused to divulge the sources of his information or how they might know what plans President Kennedy might have had. Frank Fiorini, the future Watergate burglar under the name Frank Sturgis, was another Trafficante associate leaking information to the press implicating Fidel Castro in JFK's murder. However, none of these other leaks hinted at the JFK-Almeida coup plan, and Martino's stories were unique in that regard, probably because, by his own admission, Martino had actually been part of the assassination plot. In addition, Martino knew Marcello, Rosselli, and Trafficante, while Fiorini was simply a bagman for Trafficante. Fiorini's information implicating Fidel and the Cubans appeared in a Florida newspaper on November 26, 1963. In the article, Fiorini claimed Oswald had been in touch with Cuban intelligence officials and had been in touch with Castro agents in Miami. The FBI immediately interviewed Fiorini, who maintained he'd been misquoted. Later, Fiorini admitted he'd received his information from John Martino. Other efforts to link Oswald and Ruby to Fidel were less sophisticated, though they sometimes echoed the information in the memo that so alarmed Alexander Haig. These additional efforts range from the fake Pedro Charles letter mailed to Oswald from Havana on November 28, 1963, to stories linking Ruby to Cuban plots. It's amazing how many dozens, sometimes hundreds of pages of follow-up FBI and CIA memos were generated because of one or two obviously fake letters or stories. It's likely that even more phony information implicating Fidel, with hundreds of pages of official follow-up memos, remains unreleased. National security concerns. That Castro might have been behind JFK's death in response to U.S. actions against him played a key role in the actions of LBJ, Hoover, and others. Hoover had almost certainly been told, at least in general terms, about the coup plan by his good friend LBJ. As former FBI agent Harry Whidbey told Vanity Fair, "We were effectively told they're only going to prove Oswald was the guy who did it. There were no co-conspirators, and there was no international conspiracy." An FBI supervisor at the time confirmed to Vanity Fair that, "Within days, we could say the JFK investigation was over. The idea that Oswald had a confederate, or was part of a group or a conspiracy, was definitely enough to place a man's career in jeopardy." Government officials conducted many secret investigations into JFK's murder, and not just because of all the phony, mob-linked stories implicating Fidel Castro. Many leads and individuals couldn't be investigated publicly or revealed to the Warren Commission, both for national security reasons and to avoid exposing the unauthorized operations and intelligence failures of various agencies and officials. The CIA, Naval Intelligence, LBJ, he asked Richard Helms to conduct one for him, and the FBI all had their own internal secret investigations of the JFK assassination. However, their results weren't shared between or even within agencies. As detailed in Chapter 2, my naval intelligence source said that after Oswald died, they quit shredding and sanitizing his surveillance files and began a lengthy investigation into the assassination. Naval intelligence officially concluded that Oswald was incapable of masterminding the assassination or of doing the actual shooting. But that investigation was not shared with most officials inside naval intelligence, and there is no indication it was ever shared with other branches of the military, the Joint Chiefs, or President Johnson. Richard Helms had more suspicions about the possible involvement of CIA personnel in JFK's death than he ever acknowledged to the Warren Commission or to any of the later congressional investigations. In a rarely noted television interview in 1992, Helms admitted that, "We checked to be sure that nobody with the CIA had been in Dallas on that particular day of JFK's assassination." Helms said they not only checked at the time, but later, when the Warren Commission was sitting. Those investigations have never been released, so there's no way to know if Helms suspected Barker or other agents. Helms had the CIA conduct its own internal investigation into Oswald and JFK's assassination, a little-known fact first uncovered years later by congressional investigators. Helms initially appointed an M-World veteran, CIA officer John Whitten, to head the agency's secret investigation. But as soon as Whitten asked Helms for files on Oswald's Cuba-related activities, he was taken off the JFK investigation and reassigned. In congressional testimony long after the fact, Whitten said that Helms hadn't told him anything about the CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel, and he was appalled when he heard about them 12 years later. Whitten also wasn't involved to see the files on Oswald that CIA agent Hunter Leak had delivered from the CIA's New Orleans office to Helms, or told about the assassination aspect of the Rolando Cubela operation. After Whitten was removed from the investigation, Helms replaced him with CIA counterintelligence chief James Angleton, under whom the internal CIA investigation seems to have been designed more to hide information than to uncover it. Angleton heard all of the claims from Mexico City that Oswald had killed JFK on Fidel Castro's orders and had access to other incendiary reports, like those concerning shadowy Cuban agent Miguel Casas Saez and young Cuban exile Gilberto Policarpo Lopez, both of whom went from Texas to Mexico City and then to Cuba. Not surprisingly, the paranoid Angleton concluded that Fidel had killed JFK and that both Saez and Lopez were involved, according to intelligence journalist Joseph Trento. 15 years later, when congressional investigators got to see many of the files about Saez and Lopez, they exposed the numerous flaws in Angleton's conclusion. In December 1963, one CIA memo says that President Johnson received a secret agency report about Oswald and JFK's assassination. Angleton's conclusions probably fed Johnson's belief that Fidel had orchestrated JFK's assassination. In addition, Helms made Angleton his key contact with the Warren Commission, both for providing it information and for withholding material Helms didn't want the commission to see. Hence, the Warren Commission saw nothing about the JFK Almeida coup plan, AmWorld, the surveillance of Oswald, any of his intelligence activities, or anything else that might have triggered a real investigation or cost Helms his job. Richard Helms mysteriously dumped exile leader Tony Verona in January 1964 for unknown reasons. Congressional investigators found that Verona had to leave Miami in early 1964 and move to New York to seek employment, and a CIA memo from August 1964 noted a New York Times article about Verona, headlined, "Cuban Anti-Castro Chief by Day Selling Cars in Jersey by Night." Verona's quick fall from grace raises suspicions that someone in the CIA, such as Helms, or perhaps even RFK, suspected that Verona was involved somehow in JFK's death. Helms had access to the Verona-Chicago Mafia payoff memos and would have known about Verona's long ties to Rosselli and Traficante through the CIA Mafia plots. Peter Dale Scott notes that an agreement was in force from the mid-1950s to the mid-1970s, exempting the CIA from a statutory requirement to report to the Justice Department any criminal activity by any of its employees or assets. If Helms knew or suspected that Verona or other CIA assets had any involvement in JFK's death, he might simply have dealt with it himself. It's important to point out that one of the first things Helms would do after becoming CIA director a few years later would be to fire another Trafficante associate, Bernard Barker, because, as Helms later testified, Barker was involved in certain gambling and criminal elements. Robert Kennedy would also have close associates conduct secret investigations of his brother's murder for much of the rest of his life. For months after his brother's murder, associates described him as being shattered, with some indicating he might have in some way blamed himself for his brother's death. RFK's secret investigations started the day JFK died, when the Attorney General called Julius Drasnin in Chicago, an expert on union corruption for the National Labor Relations Board, according to author David Talbot. He said that RFK asked Drasnin to look into whether there was any mafia involvement in the killing of his brother. Drasnin turned in his report 3 days after Ruby had shot Oswald. Drasnin's report detailed Ruby's labor racketeering activities and wide syndicate contacts. RFK later said that when he saw Ruby's phone records, the list was almost a duplicate of the people I called before the Senate Rackets Committee. Robert Kennedy conducted his own secret investigation of JFK's murder, using Walter Sheridan, the head of his Get Hoffa squad. Sheridan's widow later confirmed that her husband and RFK worked together on the secret inquiry. John Davis independently confirmed that Walter Sheridan had conducted an informal investigation and concluded Marcello might well have been involved. According to Sheridan's son, the search left Sheridan convinced that President Kennedy had been killed by a conspiracy. Those investigations are probably why, by 1966, RFK would tell his friend Richard Goodwin that he thought that mob guy in New Orleans, Marcello, was behind his brother's death, as Goodwin told me. The following year, after David Ferry's name finally surfaced as a suspect in JFK's murder, RFK had his press aide, Frank Mankiewicz, conduct yet another secret investigation. Mankiewicz said he came to the conclusion that there was some sort of conspiracy, probably involving the mob, anti-Castro Cuban exiles, and maybe rogue CIA agents. But when he tried to tell RFK, it was like he just couldn't focus on it. He'd get this look of pain, or more like numbness on his face. It just tore him apart. In late 1963, that numbing pain was still constant for RFK. But he seemed determined to do something about Cuba and the coup plan. He seems to have become confident that the coup plan with Almeida was still secure enough to continue. My source, John H. Crimmins, coordinator of Cuban affairs for the U.S. State Department, told me that nothing ever surfaced to make him think Castro was involved in JFK's murder, even after it was looked at over the course of the days and weeks after JFK's death. He felt the same way, even decades later. Also, a formerly top-secret, eyes-only memo from Gordon Chase of the National Security Council staff implies that McGeorge Bundy, the president's special assistant for national security affairs, was able to provide some type of assurances re Oswald on December 3, 1963, which indicated that Oswald was not a Castro agent. Commander Almeida was still safe and undetected, but the same wasn't true for one of his associates. A couple of rumors about the Almeida coup plan were reported to the CIA in the days after JFK's death, and it's possible that Fidel's agents in Miami might have heard the same or similar rumors. Perhaps out of caution, Commander Almeida left Cuba in a way that would not arouse suspicion. On Thursday, November 28, 1963, a CIA memo was sent from the Miami station to McCone reporting the departure of two Britannias airliners, probably for Algeria, with 170 Cubans aboard headed by Juan Almeida. Commander Almeida's information, or his instinct, was correct, because just 2 days later, on Saturday, November 30, a CIA memo revealed that a Western diplomat had learned from someone in the Cuban government that Che Guevara was alleged to be under house arrest for plotting to overthrow Castro. This wasn't just some rumor off the street, because the CIA said the source of the information about Che's involvement in an anti-Castro plot was a trained observer of proven reliability who is a member of the Western diplomatic community in Cuba. The timing of Che's arrest, just 1 day before the originally scheduled coup date, raises the possibility that Fidel had learned something about the coup and had arrested one of those he thought was responsible. Che's house arrest probably lasted for only a short time, perhaps just a day or two. December 2 is one of Cuba's biggest holidays, the anniversary of the founding of the Cuban army, whose first battle saw Almeida save his friend Che's life. As commander of Cuba's army, Almeida was also considered its founder, so the Cuban public would definitely notice if he didn't appear for the celebration. Apparently, things had calmed down enough for Almeida to return from Algeria to be part of the celebration, something Almeida could not have done if he feared that he was returning home to the same fate as Che. The day after the big December 2, 1963 celebration, a CIA report says Almeida expressed his despair to a subordinate. But at some point after that, Almeida communicated to Harry Williams that he was still willing to stage a coup against Fidel if RFK and new President Lyndon Johnson would back him. RFK believed that a free and democratic Cuba would be the best memorial to his slain brother. Williams was ready as well, and he tried to use his contact in Cyrus Vance's office, Joseph Califano, to arrange a meeting with LBJ. Williams said that Califano told him that upon hearing Williams' name, LBJ had evoked the Kennedys' responsibility for the Bay of Pigs disaster, and then declared, "I don't want to see any goddamn Cuban, especially that son-of-a-bitch Williams." Apparently, LBJ had heard enough about the coup plan from McCone to worry that JFK's death was retaliation from Castro. In the early weeks of January 1964, RFK decided to swallow his pride, put his own feelings aside, and plead his case personally to President Johnson. Their relationship had been terrible since 1960 and had worsened since JFK's death because Robert Kennedy felt that Johnson had moved into the White House and asserted control too quickly. But Robert Kennedy's meeting with LBJ about the coup plan did not go well. Only the two of them were present, and RFK later told Williams that President Johnson listened sympathetically but made it clear that he would not continue with the plan. LBJ's decision also included ending the Cuban exile troop training program at Fort Benning, since those exiles' real purpose had been to be among the first U.S. troops into Cuba after the coup. However, LBJ did agree to continue funding RFK's favored Cuban exile groups in case they proved useful in the future. This was LBJ's way of preserving his options and asserting control. Formally, Cuban operations had essentially been run by Robert Kennedy through Army Secretary Cyrus Vance and Richard Helms. Now, the CIA would take primary responsibility, with McCone reporting to LBJ, and RFK no longer had any role in Cuban operations. RFK offered to back Williams with his personal fortune, but Williams felt they had both done and sacrificed enough. So he went back to being a mining engineer, far away from the intrigue of exile politics. Williams communicated the news to Almeida, who apparently ended any planning for a coup. According to Williams, RFK made sure Almeida's family, still outside of Cuba on a seemingly innocent pretext, was covertly sent $3,000 that the family used, and then in addition to that money, Bobby sent them a pension. You know, they received a check every month. Out of the budget, apparently, of the CIA. Almeida's first wife and two daughters reportedly never returned to Cuba to live, and those payments continued for decades. As for who in the agency continued making those covert payments and monitoring the CIA's surveillance of Almeida's family, those files have not been released. However, at least initially, it was probably E. Howard Hunt and his aide, Bernard Barker, since they had already been working on the top-secret operation. A month after his meeting with President Johnson, RFK himself was expressing a different, more enlightened attitude about Castro. In an exchange with CIA official Desmond Fitzgerald, RFK proposed seeking an accommodation with Fidel instead of trying to overthrow him. That was emblematic of RFK's development over the next 4 years, as he grew from being a tough bulldog of a prosecutor and protector of JFK to being one of the most progressive members of the Senate. CIA official Richard Helms had not changed his feelings about Fidel, however. Files show that Helms combined the remnants of RFK's exile operation, Manuel Artime, Manolo Rey, and Eloy Menoyo, with his own CIA mafia and Kubela assassination plots. Hunt's friend Artime continued to get the lion's share of the money, which CIA accounts say totaled $7 million, while some former officials say it was several times that amount. With planes and ships going to his Central American bases full of CIA arms and supplies, and returning empty of cargo, Artime was also soon involved in drug trafficking with Santo Traficante's organization. A December 6, 1963 attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro involving Herminio Diaz, Traficante's bodyguard and narcotics trafficker, was first documented in 2006 by author Larry Hancock. One CIA memo talks about an assassination attempt on Fidel Castro after his TV appearance on 12/6, and Fitzgerald or one of his men added a comment linking it to continuing rumors of a plot to assassinate Castro which is connected with Herminio Diaz. On the day after Diaz's attempt to kill Fidel, Helms approved a December 7, 1963 memo sending low-level Cuban official Rolando Kubela a weapons cache of shotguns, pistols, grenades, C4 explosives, and rifles with scopes. The material, especially appropriate for an assassination attempt, was slated to be delivered in January 1964 under David Morales' supervision. Morales remained good friends with Johnny Rosselli, and in 1964, Morales made at least one trip to visit the Mafia Don in Las Vegas. Rosselli continued to split his time between Las Vegas and Los Angeles, where he moved into a large, lavish apartment on Beverly Glen, near Beverly Hills. Prospering in the immediate years after the JFK assassination, Rosselli even joined the prestigious L.A. Friars Club, and was soon bilking stars of the era, including Milton Berle and Phil Silvers, in an elaborate poker scam. Helms kept other aspects of the CIA mafia plots going as well, retaining European assassin recruiter Q.J. Wynn on the CIA payroll in December and for several months thereafter, until reports about Traficante's associate Michel Victor Mertz surfaced in Europe and to the CIA, at which point Q.J. Wynn was fired. As for Mertz, the Warren Commission never learned about him, though the FBI gave them, with no explanation, a few memos showing the Bureau had checked for airline passengers in Dallas named Mertz on December 22, 1963. Aside from having $1 million in heroin stolen from him in France near the one-year anniversary of JFK's death, Mertz prospered and lived extremely well after the assassination. According to one report, one of his homes was a gigantic estate in the Loire region near Orleans, measuring about 5 miles on one side by about 6 or 7 miles on the other. In Paris, Mertz had a swank townhouse on Boulevard Suchet, an area also home to the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. Even after his heroin network was busted at Fort Benning, Georgia, in 1965, and Mertz was profiled in a Pulitzer Prize-winning heroin exposé by Newsday, Mertz served only a brief, comfortable detention in France a few years later. While the man whose alias Mertz used in 1963, Jean Sutre, eventually talked to journalists and allowed himself to be photographed, Mertz remained reclusive and threatening to investigators until his death on January 15, 1995. Even his death was kept relatively secret for such a notorious figure, hindering efforts to get U.S. government files about him released. A far more lowly member of the heroin network Mertz shared with Trafficante and Marcello did not live nearly as long. Rose Cherami's statements about a plot to kill JFK were finally taken seriously by authorities after JFK's assassination. On Monday, November 25, she revealed new information about her sometime boss, Jack Ruby, to Louisiana State Police Lieutenant Francis Frouge. Frouge investigated and confirmed her claims about a heroin ring operating in Texas and that she had worked for Ruby as a B-girl. But authorities in Houston lost track of the heroin courier Cherami had identified and closed the case. Congressional investigators found that in 1965, Cherami had tried to tell the FBI about a heroin deal operating from a New Orleans ship, and even though the Coast Guard verified an ongoing narcotics investigation of the ship, the FBI had decided not to pursue the case. 1 month after she contacted the FBI, Cherami was found mortally wounded under unusual circumstances on a desolate road in Texas, and she died on September 4, 1965. Carlos Marcello, Santo Trafficante, and most of their associates prospered after JFK's murder. According to historian Richard Mahoney, as Bill Hundley, head of the Justice Department's organized crime section, put it, "The minute that bullet hit Jack Kennedy's head, it was all over. Right then, the organized crime program just stopped, and Hoover took control back." Marcello had been right. Cut the dog's head off, and the rest of it would die. More confirmation for the success of Marcello's approach comes from the FBI's own electronic surveillance transcripts of a conversation between Sam Giancana and a lieutenant 2 weeks after JFK's death, in which the lieutenant told Giancana, "I will tell you something. In another 2 months from now, the FBI will be like it was 5 years ago." That wasn't completely true, and the FBI did step up its efforts against organized crime after JFK's murder. Also, while Robert Kennedy remained Attorney General, there were still prosecutions to continue against Marcello for jury tampering and multiple counts against Jimmy Hoffa. In 1964, the juror Marcello had bribed for his November 22, 1963 acquittal went to the authorities, since Marcello had paid him only $1,000 instead of the promised $25,000, which would have attracted too much attention to the juror. Shortly after that, the U.S. attorney in New Orleans learned that Marcello had threatened to kill the government's main witness during the same trial. In late 1964, RFK resigned as Attorney General to run for the U.S. Senate in New York, but he left the Justice Department in the hands of his trusted deputy, Nicholas Katzenbach, who announced on October 6, 1964, that Carlos Marcello had been indicted for conspiracy and obstruction of justice, including seeking the murder of a government witness. 4 weeks later, RFK won his race to become a New York senator. Marcello would not be tried until the following year, and he would be found not guilty on August 17, 1965. John H. Davis wrote that Carlos Marcello was well on his way to becoming the wealthiest and most influential mafia leader in the U.S., and his organization's estimated annual income of $2 billion made it, by far, the largest industry in Louisiana. Jimmy Hoffa was not so lucky. And by the spring of 1964, Robert Kennedy's Justice Department and the head of his Get Hoffa Squad, Walter Sheridan, had finally succeeded in convicting Jimmy Hoffa for the first time. Hoffa would also be convicted on separate charges in Chicago, and only a flurry of appeals delayed the start of his long prison sentences. In 1964, Jack Ruby faced murder charges for killing Lee Oswald. In the press at that time, Ruby was not connected to the mafia or considered any type of mobster, which would remain true for more than 10 years. Melvin Belli eventually took over Ruby's defense. His law partner had first been called on November 24, 1963, by someone from Las Vegas connected with mobsters who'd had casinos in Havana. The call didn't come from Johnny Rosselli, but it did come from his Las Vegas headquarters hotel, the Desert Inn. The Las Vegas caller wanted Belli to defend Ruby, who was described as one of our guys. Belli was close to Los Angeles gangster Mickey Cohen, who was a good friend of Carlos Marcello. A CIA memo says that Belli was reportedly involved in